From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Shoddy journalism or a military cover-up? Whatever happened to the charges that the U.S. military used sarin gas on its own soldiers during Vietnam? Today, a conversation with the two producers CNN fired under pressure from the military. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Nigeria. Up to 60 people have died in the violence following Mashood Abiola's death. Local newspapers there today report 11 more deaths in Lagos and 4 in a university town where student protesters set fire to the local high court building. The ruling military council said late yesterday that it had commuted death sentences on 6 of Abiola's Yoruba kinsmen who were convicted of plotting to overthrow the late dictator Sani Abacha and asked security agencies to compile a full list of political detainees for possible amnesty. Meanwhile, a team of foreign pathologists began to assemble in Lagos yesterday to prepare for the autopsy of Abiola, whose death in prison sparked riots in his southwestern home region where his loyalists are accusing the military of killing him. The California Supreme Court has ruled that Dow Corning, the bankrupt maker of silicone breast implants, cannot be sued over toxicology tests it conducted years before the implants were invented. Yesterday's decision to uphold two lower court rulings dismisses claims for 1,600 California women who blamed the implants for pain, disfigurement, and autoimmune disorders. The women were hoping to circumvent Dow Corning's bankruptcy by suing its two solvent parent companies, Dow Chemical and Corning Inc. They're among some 170,000 women considering a $3.2 billion settlement offer announced by a federal bankruptcy judge in Michigan yesterday. Teamsters have accused the United Parcel Service of trying to sidestep a promise to create 2,000 full-time jobs by the end of the month, a major part of the settlement that ended last summer's 15-day strike. UPS spokesperson Norman Black said the nation's largest shipping company had notified the union it won't add the jobs this year, saying package volume hasn't rebounded completely from the strike. A Teamsters spokesperson said the union will hold rallies nationwide on July 31st, the one-year anniversary of the strike's launch, to protest the lack of new jobs. He said he expects the dispute to be resolved through grievances and in the court of public opinion. The United States is continuing to fight efforts to create an international criminal court. In a statement released yesterday from Rome, where 161 nations are meeting to establish the court, the U.S. said it fears American soldiers might be vulnerable to war crimes charges. The Pentagon, meanwhile, says it worries that American soldiers who unwittingly kill civilians during, quote, peacekeeping missions could find themselves facing charges of crimes against humanity. Washington says it will not support a court with no veto power for the U.S. Many other nations, however, believe that only a court free of U.S. domination will have teeth. India's prime minister said today that New Delhi would not bow to Western pressure to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty unconditionally, but was ready for talks on the pact. India argues that the pact would permit the 5 recognized nuclear powers, Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States, to fine-tune their arsenals with non-explosive techniques while holding others in check, and would not bind them to disarm within a specified time frame. British Prime Minister Tony Blair said today the British government would enforce the rule of law without fear or favor in Northern Ireland and described attacks on security forces as unacceptable. Blair spoke after 5 Northern Ireland police officers were seriously injured in increasingly violent clashes today, with Protestants angered at a ban on their annual march through a Flashpoint Catholic area. 4 of the officers suffered shrapnel injuries when 2 nail bombs were thrown across police lines. And Russian President Boris Yeltsin sought support from foreign leaders today to overcome a severe economic crisis and said Russia could crush any, quote, extremist attempt to seize power. Yeltsin, who said the crisis might be dangerous socially and politically, also decided to stay in Moscow next week and take his summer vacation later. And finally, since stone scriptures of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Archbishop Oscar Romero of El Salvador, and eight others were unveiled in the Westminster Abbey, reserved for 20th century Christian martyrs, the men and women were chosen after wide consultation to represent major areas of persecution and oppression. That's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Shoddy journalism or a military cover-up? We've heard a lot about the retractions, reprimands, and firings. But what about the charges that the U.S. used sarin gas against its own troops during the Vietnam War? Today, a conversation with the two producers, formerly with CNN, who were fired under pressure from the military for a piece they did for CNN Newsstand, a new program that airs on Sunday nights on CNN. We're joined by April Oliver, who was the producer reporter on the piece, and Jack Smith, who was the producer, did some reporting, was senior producer on that piece. They're longtime reporters and producers. Jack Smith comes from a 23-year history with CBS, where he was the Washington bureau chief and also worked at CBS Chicago and with the Chicago Daily News. April Oliver was 4.5 years with CNN. Before that, 5 years at the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. Well, in the last days, we've been seeing the headliner about Peter Arnett, that he was reprimanded as the face on this story, but that he would not be losing his job. April Oliver and Jack Smith, on the other hand, were fired for this piece that was done called Valley of Death. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you for being
here.
Well, let's begin with April Oliver. As I said, what we haven't heard very much about since this piece came out were the details of the piece and the charges. Can you lay out the story for us?
Well, the story sums up a 4-day mission that occurred in Laos in 1970, in which an elite unit of secret commandos called the Studies and Observations Group went into Laos on essentially a killing mission. Their orders were basically to kill everything in sight down to the last blade of grass. There were 16 Americans and about 140 Molten Yard mercenaries. They were dropped deep into Laos on the deepest penetration by Laos by these special operations forces ever, and they were assisted by Marines and Air Force above. They were on the ground 4 days. Their target was a village base camp in which Americans had been spotted by reconnaissance units who were strung around in a circle around this village base camp. After decimating the village with a body count of over 100, the men were then out of ammunition and extremely exhausted, and they were trying to get out desperately. The enemy, of course, at this point is very mad, and they have anti-aircraft guns. The enemy is seated up on a ridge line bearing down upon the commando unit. And in last resort, desperate measure, the men on the ground are told to put their gas masks on. A lethal nerve gas called sarin was dropped, as this is what we report according to Special Forces sources. And the Americans, miraculously, 16 Americans get out alive. There's some question about the number of Molten Yards that get out alive, but the enemy body count on this mission is between 400 and 500, and again, all 16 Americans get out alive. That is the basic outline.
Jack Smith, can you put this in the context of this very secret war that was taking place in Laos?
Well, that's, I think, at the root of the story. This is the blackest, deepest, one of the blackest, deepest operations of the secret army, that is the SOG team, in the secret war in Laos. The Nixon administration, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, and certainly the CIA had their hands wrapped around the secret war in Cambodia and the secret war in Laos. The secret war in Laos was being waged principally by these strikes by these commando units behind enemy lines in the along the Ho Chi Minh Rail. This team that went in, this commando unit, was company size. Their orders were to kill everything in sight, and that's what they did. They went in to completely wreak havoc behind the enemy lines and show the North Vietnamese and the Pathet Lao and the VC that were operating down the Ho Chi Minh Trail that they could kill just as effectively, and that meant everybody and anybody in sight, as the NVA, VC, and Pathet Lao were doing. So what we were up against was penetrating the deep secrecy, the pledges of deniability, the pledges of secrecy that went with this secret army operation in the secret war, Nixon's secret war in Laos.
April Oliver, can you talk about the fact that you charge in this piece that defectors, U.S. defectors, were targeted?
Yes, that is what we came to learn. I mean, one of the crucial turning points for me was when we found the reconnaissance teams. I have to tell you that a number of the press coverage of this particular story have said that she set out with a sarin gas defector's thesis. Nothing could be further from the truth. I set out not knowing what the gas was, but aware that a powerful gas had been used. And I hadn't a clue, frankly, that defectors had anything to do with this operation. It wasn't until 6 months into the research when I found one of the reconnaissance men who were stationed up on that ridgeline who said, "Oh, yeah, that was the mission where that big hatchet force team was dropped in, and oh, yeah, it was to raid a camp, and there were these either prisoners or defectors down there, and the mission was to wipe out that village." Well, that was a huge turning point for me when I realized that there actually were teams of American reconnaissance units spotting for Americans in this village. And it wasn't just one person we talked to. There were several other teams as well that actually eyeballed or were told to look for Americans in this particular site. So I went back to, once I'd found these people, I went back to some of the men on the ground and started pressing them to be more open with me on what they found when they went into that village. And one of them said, "Well, you know, my boss told me to say it was just a Russian, and he told me to purge it from my memory. But the reality was I saw this white Caucasian streaking through camp, and I knew it to be a defector. I was sure it was a turncoat. He had long blonde hair, and he looked like he just came off a beach in California. And I asked him to stop, and I said, 'We've come to take you home,' but he gave an expletive, and I said, 'No, F you.' And he describes in vivid detail killing this defector."
Now, these are explosive charges, to say the least, to say that the U.S. was targeting U.S. defectors and killing them and using sarin gas, something that the U.S. has lately been accusing Saddam Hussein of, and also saying, at least at the time, said they had never used sarin gas in Vietnam. Is that right?
That's correct.
These are explosive charges, but at the same time, you have to understand that we did try to prepare CNN management for the controversy that we knew would be coming. Both Jack and I got together and put together a 156-page briefing book that would that laid out both our sources and our and the controversy that we felt sure would follow. Please keep in mind that one of the things that's important to realize about the context of the times is not only that was this a black operation in which there were no rules of engagement, but at the time the United States itself had not yet ratified the treaty which prohibits the use of nerve gas. That did not happen until 1975. So when I talked to a number of my sources, they all, many of them stressed that, keep in mind, it wasn't technically illegal.
a very key point. We're talking to former CNN producers April Oliver and Jack Smith, both fired for a recent report that they put together called Valley of Death, charging that U.S. defectors were targeted by U.S. troops in the secret war in Laos, targeted with sarin gas. That's right, the nerve gas that kills. Now let's talk about how well you substantiated your story. CNN called in the well-known First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams to do a report, an investigation of your investigation. And he concluded that you didn't substantiate a story that, though he did say you believe deeply in it, and he doesn't believe that there were any intentional lies told. Talk about the people that you interviewed on this 18-minute report that viewers saw that made these allegations.
Well, first of all, let me address the Abrams report. It's really the Abrams-Kohler report. And it's a tainted report because of the presence of Mr. David Kohler on it. Mr. Abrams is a famous New York lawyer with a long and distinguished career, but in this particular case, his using Mr. David Kohler, who is CNN's House Counsel, as his joined-at-the-hip co-investigator on it, taints the report from the beginning. He was hired by, that is, Mr. Abrams was hired by management. He did not do this pro bono. Mr. Kohler, of course, reports to management. Mr. Kohler had signed off on both reports on Tailwind. He had deeply involved himself in the editorial process. Mr. Abrams, as any young man or woman out of law school would have realized, should have asked Mr. Kohler to step aside and should have gone in, for example, as I requested, a dean of a journalism school to be his co-investigator. So what you've got is a report that was written to underwrite CNN management's cave-in on this story under the weight of the military establishment.
April Oliver, tell us about the people you have on camera who allege that the U.S. government, the U.S. military, used sarin gas in the secret war in Laos to target and kill U.S. defectors.
Well, let's talk. I mean, this is a nuanced report, and let's talk very specifically about some of the individuals involved. Everybody brought a different piece of information to the reporting. One of the people that ties the gas to sarin gas is the reconnaissance officer named Jay Graves. He was the man sitting up on the ridgeline whose team spotted these group of Americans that they didn't know if they were POWs or defectors down in this village. Now, Jay Graves, when we talked to him, said, well, he knew that it was knockout gas or sleeping gas that pulled this commando unit out. But later in his career in 1972, when he was at Fort Bragg, he found out that the real name of sleeping gas was GB. Now, GB is the military term for sarin nerve gas. So he's a person who, through the course of his military training, found out himself that this mysterious knockout gas or sleeping gas, which people describe as odorless and colorless, was indeed GB or sarin. Van Buskirk, who's another lead figure in this piece, never says the word it was sarin, but says sleeping gas was slang for nerve gas. And he also says that he was briefed privately by an Air Force official, a colonel, that the sleeping gas that would be used in this particular mission was lethal. A third person who makes the allegation is a member of the commando unit named Michael Hagan. And Hagan has a direct deductive approach to this. He's now suffering from something called peripheral neuropathy. He's slowly going paralyzed in his limbs. His gas mask was shot full of bullet holes, and he got a real powerful whiff of this stuff and actually started going into convulsions on the battlefield. He's now suffering the side effects of this. His doctor has diagnosed him as having nerve gas poisoning. He said very clearly on camera that the government wants to call this incapacitating agent, but this wasn't incapacitating agent. This was nerve gas. Finally, there is Admiral Moore. There's been a bit of controversy about our use of him as a confirming source, but Admiral Moore was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1970 at the time of this operation. Admiral Moore does give us a yes that GB sarin nerve gas was useful on this proved effective on this operation. And furthermore, Admiral Moore, 6 days before air, we went to the extraordinary lengths of allowing Admiral Moore to read the script. We thought, given the number of conversations we've had with him, given the nature of the fact that at first he was did not confirm, but then came around to confirming the use of sarin nerve gas, we thought it appropriate to let him know how we were couching his confirmation, and he signed off on the script, lock, stock, and barrel. So those are four on-camera sources that give us the confirmation that a lethal nerve gas was used on this operation. And, of course, when you look at a chemical manual, there are only two nerve gases in the U.S. arsenal at this time. One of them is VX, which kills through the skin. But the other one is sarin, and the only thing you need to be protected from sarin is a well-fitting, well-sealed chemical nuclear biological gas mask.
We're talking to former, I should say fired, CNN producers April Oliver and Jack Smith. They are the primary producers and reporters of this piece that has caused such a stir and that also led to a reprimand of Peter Arnett, who was the narrator of this piece, the well-known Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with these two producers. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are the two fired CNN producers who produced this report, Valley of Death, that aired several weeks ago and has created a great deal of controversy. They were both fired for the report, but continue to stand behind it 100%, something that certainly CNN did not do. It led to a great deal of controversy, including suggestions that Henry Kissinger and Colin Powell stepped forward and threatened CNN, at least according to the producers, saying that the CNN would no longer have access to the military if they did not retract this report. We'll get to that in a minute. But critics are saying that Admiral Moore is senile and that he never clearly stated on screen that sarin gas was used.
I would say this to those critics. Go spend 8 hours with Admiral Moore. He is the most... first of all, let me say he's an extremely courageous man for even broaching this topic with a reporter. He didn't have to do it. He made a conscious decision to do it. We had very polite conversations. We had very frank conversations. And in terms of his agility of his mind, I would have to tell you that he was correcting me much of the time. Even the Abrams report, which is critical of us, says Admiral Moore's memory is sound. And I would say that it's not only sound, but it is excellent.
But didn't he say after the report came out that he didn't believe sarin gas was used?
Well, I'd like to go through that a little bit because I think it's important. The day he started his waiver after the report came out, he said to Reuters in a wire service, "Well, I believe the men on the ground, and I definitely had heard rumors that sarin gas had been used on this operation." Well, when we read that on the wires, both Jack and I got into the car and went out to see Admiral Moore. Because anybody who's read the script top to bottom and has spent as much time with us as he did and never once used the word rumors, we felt it was important to challenge him on that. So we went out and spent 2 hours with Admiral Moore yet again. And he looked at me rather sheepishly and said, well, you know, people today really don't understand the context of the times back then. He'd been taking phone calls from a lot of his colleagues and friends at the Pentagon all day long who were, needless to say, not real happy with what was his appearance on our show. And then he went on to say, by appearing on your show and saying what I said, people think that I authorized this operation. And it was not I that authorized this operation. And then he pointed at the White House. It was clear that Admiral Moore didn't want to go down in history as being the man who authorized the use of lethal nerve gas on a neutral country in a secret mission in a secret war. And so that's where his wavering comes from.
Did he say directly that it was President Nixon or the National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger?
He was a bit vaguer. He said Kissinger would know. And when I pressed on who I should go to at the White House, he told me to go talk to Kissinger. Hmm. But he would not flatly say, yes, it was Kissinger.
And I must point out that we had made repeated requests to Henry Kissinger to interview for this story, and we got repeated turndowns by Kissinger, who, of course, was Nixon's National Security Advisor. But Mr. Kissinger was on the phone with Tom Johnson after the report, saying that the report was not accurate and that it should be retracted. And Mr. Kissinger, however, was nowhere to be seen before the story when we requested interviews from him. As a matter of fact, he hasn't made a public statement on this. He's only talked, to my knowledge, to Tom Johnson privately, but Johnson told us of these conversations with Kissinger. So the pressure points begin with Kissinger. They flow right through the Pentagon, Ken Bacon, who had Tom Johnson's ear throughout this, and even marched us over, ordered us over to the Pentagon to sit down and meet with Bacon after the two stories had aired. It came from the Special Forces, the Green Beret Association, and the Commando Associations. They were all into Tom Johnson's ear, into Rick Kaplan's ear, pressing for a retraction. And CNN management, Mr. Johnson and Rick Kaplan, the head of CNN News, Kaplan said in a conference call that April was on down in D.C., I was in Kaplan's office, and he said, this is not a journalistic problem, this is a PR problem, and we got to solve it. And Kaplan went on to say that he did not want this story to go forward because he was scared to death of congressional hearings. And he didn't want that to happen. So Johnson and Kaplan, between them, gagged us from talking about the story. They would not let any further reporting continue. Kaplan had initiated the idea of doing an Opposing Views Hour special, and we were ready to put that story on the air. But all of a sudden, when the command decision was made by Kaplan and Johnson to let's just get this story behind us, that idea was scrubbed.
I just want to clarify something. They were terrified of congressional hearings into the revelations that sarin gas was used in the secret war in Laos, or
right,
congressional hearings investigating CNN?
No, congressional hearings into the fact-finding of sarin nerve gas use in Laos and the policy to kill defectors.
Why would they be afraid of that?
Well, that's a very good question, because a news organization shouldn't be afraid of that. They should seek the truth. But Kaplan felt, and this is another extension of that same statement, was that he didn't want 3,000 establishment guys on one side of the room, led by Colin Powell, and our bag of little special operating group operatives on the other side of the room, that this would not look good for CNN to be on the other side of the room from people such as Colin Powell.
According to the New York Times of Wednesday, July 8th, it says that both of you, April Oliver and also Jack Smith, say you believe the network caved in to the pressure from former top officials like Henry Kissinger and General Colin Powell, but network executives deny this.
Well, I'm sure that's their position, and we, all I can say is that Jack and I both heard these statements with our own ears and felt the pressure to be muzzled. So we know the pressure not only to have been at the executive suite in terms of, you know, person-to-person executive pressure from the likes of Powell and Kissinger and Richard Helms, but also in the pocketbook. Yeah, also the pocketbook. I mean, there was a threat, Special Forces Association called in that they were considering a lawsuit against CNN for maligning their organization. There was the threat of a cable boycott, that veterans groups were going to get together and call for cable operators to take CNN off the cable stations. So there were threats at various levels here. And I think that CNN, given its declining ratings, felt it just could not sustain this controversy.
We're talking to producers April Oliver and Jack Smith, both formerly with CNN. They've just been fired for the report they did, Valley of Death, on their charges that sarin gas was used to target U.S. defectors in the secret war in Laos. Now, one of the people, Robert Van Buskirk, Operation Tailwind veteran, says they're shooting anything that moves. This was the Valley of Death. And he goes on to be quoted a few times in your piece. This is a man who's also at the center of controversy because isn't it Buskirk who critics are saying suffered from repressed memory, and that you didn't mention this in the piece, that this is the first time, even after writing a book on what he did in Vietnam, that he is saying that U.S. defectors were targeted?
Yes, let me address that. We were on L.A. radio yesterday. Van Buskirk was on with us, and he says the repressed memory business is hogwash, and let me tell you why it's hogwash. In all of our interviews and face-to-face conversations, both on camera and off camera, with Bob Van Buskirk, he never once mentions or raises repressed memory. When April first questioned him about the killing of the defectors in the camp, she starts the conversation off by saying, "Have you ever heard the term long shadows?" Which is the common term for Americans or Caucasians that they used out there in this Asian conflict, because obviously they're taller than the Asians. And Bob responded, "Long shadows." That rings a bell. Later in the conversation, April goes back to the term "long shadows," and Van Buskirk says, "Long shadows." That brings back memories. Now, if that's repressed memory syndrome, then I ought to be the chief psychiatrist at a big hospital. I mean, here, April, a reporter raises the term long shadows, and Bob Van Buskirk says it rings a bell and it brings back memories. The first time that we see this repressed memory business raised is from Newsweek. And tomorrow, we're going to sit down with Evan Thomas of Newsweek, who wrote that story, and we're going to sit down. We're going to lay our notes out, and he's going to lay his notes out, and we'll talk about this whole phony business of repressed memory.
What is really important,
because it doesn't exist. It's not there.
What's really important to stress is that Bob Van Buskirk, from the very first moment I talked with him, said, "I killed a Caucasian in that camp." It wasn't like he blanked out killing a white man. The only thing that changed during the course of 8 months of reporting on this was he came to tell me towards the end of it, "Well, you know, when I saw that white Caucasian, I thought he was a turncoat, but my boss told me to expunge that the thought of a turncoat from my memory, and if anyone ever asked me about it, to tell them it was a Russian." Because, you know, obviously the notion of Americans killing Americans was an extremely volatile political issue, and the American government, the American military, didn't want anybody running around bragging that they'd knocked off one of their own.
And I should point out that a defector collaborating with the enemy, in the eyes of the military, and I would say in the eyes of a lot of people who are the civilians who support the military, would say, "What in the blaze is wrong with killing defectors who are collaborating with the enemy? They have become the enemy." And that was the view of the commandos out there. it was known among commandos that if you spotted a defector and he was a defector collaborating with the enemy, you had to make an instant judgment and you were to kill him. You weren't supposed to bring him back. The mission of SOG was to kill everything that moves.
And how many soldiers do you say were involved with SOG? How many?
Oh, over the course of 10 years, there were some 2,000 Americans that participated. One thing to keep in mind is that these soldiers, they were brave. There is no question about it that they were some of the most unusual, fiercest fighters that the American military ever produced. They went on extremely high-risk missions, and that's one reason they were allowed to use any weapon of their choice, except for nuclear weapons. They had no rules of engagement. They were often outnumbered hundreds and hundreds to one. And I don't want to at all belittle their courage. We met many soldiers along the way who we admire, and these were the orders they were given. And the reason that the nerve gas was pre-approved is because the odds were so great against them that, you know, you're in a situation where you're surrounded by enemy and it looks like you're going to die, and the only difference between you and the enemy is that you've got the gas mask and they don't. What do you think you're going to do?
We're talking to former CNN producers April Oliver and Jack Smith, both fired for their report, Valley of Death. We're going to come back to this conversation in just a minute. Find out why these men, who were part of the Studies and Observations Group, the SOG, part of Operation Tailwind, even spoke to these producers, knowing that this would be a story that would get out. And then find out about just how journalism works, why it is they were fired, Peter Arnett was not. Find out about the military threats to CNN around the issue of access. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives and get a cassette. That's 1-800-735-0230. Again, to order a cassette, 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are fired CNN producers April Oliver and Jack Smith. Again, they are longtime producers. Jack Smith, having an illustrious career of 23 years at CBS, both Washington bureau chief as well as Chicago's, also worked with the Chicago Daily News. We are also talking to April Oliver, who was with CNN for 4.5 years, before that 5 years at McNeil Lehrer. Why did these men who are part of the special operations group, Operation Tailwinds, that tell you on screen that they were involved with targeting U.S. defectors with sarin gas during the secret war in Laos, why do they speak to you now?
Well, let me first clarify the sarin gas against defectors. The sources for the sarin gas dropped on the village base camp the night before the commando unit went in there and killed everything in sight were not the men on the ground. The men on the commando unit were some distance removed from the village base camp the night before when two A1Es or a couple of A1Es, it may have been more than two, it was dark. It was 8 o'clock at night, approximately 8 o'clock at night. A1Es came in and dropped nerve gas on the camp, and we got that from sources other than the men on the ground. These were people up higher in the chain of command in special forces. So those were our sources for the dropping of the gas on the camp. Now, the gas was dropped on the camp, according to these two sources, the night before. But there is no way to determine what the impact of that drop was. The recon fellow who was up watching the camp and the aerial resupply man knew that the plane swept down, but they couldn't tell what type of drop they made because it was just too dark and they were too far away. They couldn't tell whether it was a strafing mission or a gas drop. But what happened was, according to our sources that were higher up in the chain of command, they did drop gas to prep that camp that night, in other words, prepare it for the commando attack the next day, which took place approximately 12 hours later. So nobody is certain how many casualties there were from that gas attack that night. We don't know whether the gas hit dead in the center of the camp or 200 yards off center of the camp, which would have made an enormous difference on the number of casualties, if any, in the camp. What it does show is the willingness to use the weapon offensively against the enemy and again and drop it on a camp where Americans who were believed to be defectors could have been prisoners of war. There was a willingness to drop it on the camp.
There are two real controversies here. One is that sarin gas was used at all, and second, that it was used against U.S. defectors.
That's correct.
Do you think you conveyed that ambiguity in your piece?
Well, I don't think there's an ambiguity there. The only it's not even an ambiguity. There's no way of telling what the casualty was from the drop the night before. What we do know is because everybody, they shot everything up in that camp when they went in the next morning. They went through that camp. There were people running around in that camp. It certainly would appear that if gas did have a strike, if the gas had hit and had impact on that camp, that there were survivors from the attack because they met resistance, albeit not a hard infantry-style resistance, but this was more like a transportation camp anyway, so you didn't necessarily have infantry fighters in that camp. So when the SOG commandos come through the camp in the morning, they came through to kill everything. As soon as they saw anybody moving, they shot them down. They went to the hooches and they grenaded all the hooches. They simply were tossing grenades in every hooch in the camp, blowing anybody inside the smithereen.
Hooches are
huts, mm-hmm. Conventional living quarters for a enemy base camp.
When I talked about ambiguities, I mean something like pilot Art Bishop, whose denial that the gas was used was later dropped, apparently because of time constraints.
Yeah, that was not Jack and my decision. I mean, Jack and I argued strenuously to include Mr. Bishop, and our final cut, which we sent to Atlanta executives, included Mr. Bishop in the piece. It was folks down in Atlanta management that actually cut Mr. Bishop out. So, you know, one of the very frustrating things about the Abrams-Kohler report is that they slam us for not having Mr. Bishop in when both Jack and I had him in. So it is very frustrating to suggest that somehow we tilted the piece, that we made it one-sided when we had not only Mr. Bishop in, but we had a strong voice in Captain McCarley saying that I wouldn't use lethal gas on my mission. And we stumbled on that village by accident. It wasn't intentional. Those points of views are in there. And finally, the Abrams-Kohler report does not make mention at all of the great effort that we went to, the repeated efforts we went to get senior officials who might lend this more skeptical point of view, officials such as Henry Kissinger, such as CIA Director Richard Helms, such as the former Chief SOG at the time, John Sadler, who really flatly and rudely turned us down, saying our letter of request to him was in the garbage can. All these voices who declined to appear on camera for the piece were only too quick to slam us in the press or call up CNN management to complain afterwards, saying that we tilted the piece. It's just a huge irony to me.
I wanted to get to the We're talking to April Oliver and Jack Smith, two CNN producers fired for their piece, Valley of Death. Let's get to the issue of reporter and producer, because I think this is shocking to the viewing public. And this gets to the issue of Peter Arnett, who was reprimanded but not fired for this piece. I know that you were both very happy that he was not fired. Now, his quotes in the Washington Post of Thursday, July 9th, for example, saying, "I was the host correspondent. I'm primarily an action reporter. I was never informed that my face on the air gave me responsibility for a major story." This is going to shock a lot of people. He says, "This was a team effort. I'm a company guy. You want me to read a script, I'll read it." He also, though, wrote an accompanying Time magazine piece in which he shared a byline with you and said, though, that he didn't write that piece. Now, in the New York Times of Thursday, July 9th, he is slammed basically by Christiane Amanpour, another CNN producer who's married to James Rubin, spokesperson for the State Department, who says, "I believe, contrary to what Peter Arnett appears to believe, that a network correspondent should be responsible for what he or she says on the air." Now, what about Peter Arnett's involvement? I mean, if what you're saying is true, that the whole report is true, it's something that he should be proud of. And if you won a major award for this piece, he would be standing there picking it up.
I got to set the phone down for a second.
Okay. I would say the following regardless. I was disappointed in Peter's representation of himself as just being a company guy. Clearly, he wasn't just a company guy. We didn't order him to read the script, and we eagerly sought his feedback on this piece. I mean, Peter has far more in-depth Vietnam and overseas experience than any person at CNN, and we relied upon his instincts in terms of what he thought was probable or possible to have happened in Laos, his understanding of how much reporting there had been on defectors, and he himself has reported on poison gas use in the Vietnam War before when he reported in the mid-60s that a vomiting gas that was sometimes lethal was used. Did he carry the major force of the story? Did he do the major bulk of the reporting? No, he did not. He did three sit-down interviews with three of the principal players,
which he said were scripted, the questions scripted by you.
Well, he certainly provided a good bulk of his own questions in that particular case. I did provide him with sample questions, and Peter is not a mannequin. He is a very thoughtful journalist. Peter certainly is under a great deal of pressure in the past 48 hours, and I applaud the fact that CNN did not fire him. Had they fired him, it would have been one of the biggest travesties in journalism history. As Jack aptly pointed out in a good soundbite earlier in the week, you could just start calling CNN CMN, Cable Military Network. Because one of the things that has been very clearly coming out in the press, I mean, CNN's Air Force consultant, former Air Force consultant Perry Smith, has said that we will not rest in the military establishment until Peter Arnett is fired, and CNN will not get cooperation with the military establishment again until this occurs. I mean, what blatant threats, what blatant blackmail. Can anybody really think that there can be, you know, integrity in journalism if the military establishment is calling the shots in terms of hirings and firings in the CNN executive suite? I'm delighted CNN has finally come to their senses in terms of taking orders from the Pentagon on this.
Yeah, I got to weigh in on that because I think that Peter's, first of all, April and I shouldn't have been fired. But Peter Arnett certainly shouldn't have been fired. And if and it's a victory for reporters everywhere. They should be rejoicing today that he was not, his head wasn't chopped off and carried over in a bag and put on the steps of the Pentagon so all the brass could come out and dance around it in a victory for the military establishment.
Do you think that he should have resigned?
Not at all. Peter, this was April's report and my report. Peter was minimally involved. Sure, he did three interviews and he bought his reporter's notebook to those interviews. We wrote the script, and April's a bloody good writer, and I'm an awfully good rewrite man, and so there wasn't much need for him to do any rewrite on the script. But his involvement was not as deep as it might have been if his schedule had allowed him to come back. But on news magazines, that's the nature of news magazines.
You mean television news magazines?
Of course, yeah. Let's face it, this from story to story, you'll get different degrees of involvement by any particular correspondent. You know, pick your way, go back over years worth of work, everywhere from 60 Minutes down through Dateline, Primetime, all that. And I think if you ran a meter on reporter involvement, it ranged probably from 10% to 100%, depending on who was producing it and who the correspondent was.
April Oliver, do you think that Peter Arnett should have resigned?
Oh, no, I do not think that at all. I think that Peter has a great job. It's a job any journalist in the world would envy, and I applaud him for, continuing his career and wish him the very best.
He did say, quoted in the Washington Post, paraphrased in the Washington Post, since we all have to be very careful here, he said he accepts the retraction but is still not certain the allegations are untrue.
Not even the Abrams report says they're untrue. I mean, one thing that's very important to point out here is that even the Abrams report, which is so flawed, said there was a lot of interesting evidence and that the investigation and the reporting should continue, and that there was a lot of carefully done research, which was interesting. No one's saying the story is false. No one's saying the story is untrue. They're merely saying, quote-unquote, there was insufficient evidence.
Peter said to me when I talked to him out in Oregon when he was taking a few days off that he would return to Washington and sit down and read the Abrams-Kohler report thoroughly. And then I said, Peter, you really need to sit down and read all the work that went into the story before you make any final judgment on it. And he said he would do that. And I take Peter at his word. He's a brave reporter. There aren't many reporters who would face all the combat he's faced over his lifetime.
Again, he did say, I was never informed. My face on the air gave me responsibility for a major story. And whatever his involvement in the CNN piece, he was one of two names in the byline and the lead piece in Time magazine with you, April Oliver. Why was his name at all included in that Time piece?
Because he did do some of the reporting for it. And we do quote from his reporting. He did the of course, the lead character in this piece was Bob Van Buskirk, and he did the key interview with Bob Van Buskirk. It wasn't I that obtained those quotes. It was he. So, you know, he did do reporting. He may not have done the writing, but he did do some of the reporting.
I understood that on the Time piece, he said he didn't know his name was going to be used, and they did it for just star recognition for the kind of draw that Time would get for having his name on a piece.
I'm not sure he said he didn't know. He certainly read it and proofed it and was aware that it was going out with his byline.
If you were to do this piece again, would you do something differently? And if it was to be longer, what else would you include?
April, go ahead.
Well, I would like to say that we did request 1 hour from management last January, thinking that 18 minutes was far, far too short, and we were flatly refused that hour. It was one of my great frustrations. I knew we had a potentially volatile story. I knew that getting the various points of view would be important. And I was very nervous about presenting this complex story to the American public without more layers of fact and factual context. However, I was turned down by management and told that we are not in the business of doing documentaries. We do news magazines. Go do a news magazine piece. I don't think even in retrospect, that even if I'd had the most powerful arguments available, that they would have given me a whole hour. I certainly would have insisted, in hindsight, 2020 hindsight, that that over my dead body you take Art Bishop out of that piece.
The man who denied.
Yeah,
that's right.
Denied.
That was a very bad error by management in Atlanta. We certainly fought it, but obviously we didn't fight it with as much fury as we should have.
And Art Bishop, we did a follow-up piece on Tailwind the following week, and Art Bishop was in that piece, and by necessity he was in that piece. He should have remained in the first piece, and I think and hope Mr. Bishop now understands why his appearance in the first piece was not there.
And on the issue of CNN, right, cable military network, what about this relationship between CNN and the military? What about this issue of what you guys charge, which is Colin Powell and Henry Kissinger threatening CNN's access to the military if this piece wasn't retracted?
Well, I'm not so sure Colin Powell made that threat.
Yeah.
Henry Kissinger was denouncing the piece and asking for a retraction. But underlying all of this is that CNN needs to protect its access to the military in order to broadcast whatever military action goes down in the future, whether it be a commando raid to rescue hostages, or whether, God forbid, it be a major move into another country. CNN considers their relationship with the Pentagon absolutely necessary to be there in the first wave, to get their satellites in, to get their reporters' teams in. Now, I know how important it is for news organizations to be right there with the troops. When I was the CBS bureau chief, I was the one who, along with a number of other bureau chiefs in Washington, went over and met with the Pentagon when we got shut out of Grenada. And we formed the whole pool concept of getting a small group to go in with the first wave of troops. So I know how important access is. But there's also a limit to the coziness of your relationship with a major institution that you're covering, whether it be a city hall or the police department or the Pentagon. You cannot get into bed with those organizations simply to assure your satellites have the proper positioning on any given news story. You got to be willing to take second row or no row and move ahead with the coverage on a very tough and controversial story that bears on Pentagon and military policy, which the citizenry of this country has a right to know about.
Where do you both go from here?
We continue to report the story as we can as freelancers. We are writing a formal rebuttal to the sham report produced by Abrams and Kohler, and that's what's laying out there ahead of us.
Jack Smith, you're 62. You're reaching retirement age. Was there any settlement with CNN?
No plans to retire. I'm continuing to work. I'm a vigorous 62, and CNN gave me two options, resign unconditionally or be fired unconditionally. They just hung me out on the yardarm, but I'm alive. They didn't kill me. Anything that doesn't kill you just makes you stronger.
That's correct.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. April Oliver and Jack Smith, the two producer reporters on the piece Valley of Death that was aired on CNN Times newsstand, has caused a great deal of controversy and cost them their jobs. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order one from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. George Wellington, thanks very much. Engineer at WNYC. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be right back.
Where would an alternative radio program on a network like Pacifica be if occasionally we did not take on the corporate establishment media? And when they run a cover story like Time Magazine did a couple of weeks ago saying, "Is feminism dead?" You know we have to think about responding. Today we're going to talk with four women here on Living Room and talk about feminism, what it means to them, where it's going today, where it's been, and where it might go from a perspective that Time Magazine never dreamed of. Hi, I'm Larry Bensky, and this is Living Room. We'll be back with us.